The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Rabbi Yeshua, the Brilliant Advocate, is the sixth of a 16-part series from Yavne to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Malka Bela Bas Menachem Ephraim Alecha HaSholem, Mrs. Beatrice Mildred Lookstein Berman of blessed memory.
Okay. The world's history books are full of the stories and exploits of the so-called greats of humanity. These are people who have excelled diverse fields, whether it be in the military, government, science, medicine, sports, entertainment, philosophy, or philanthropy, or numerous other different fields. But it's rare to find someone who excels in more than one field. And even rarer is the person who's able to master a broad spectrum of fields. The sports world has a special place for such a person. The Olympic Games, there's an event, the decathlon, where there's eight difficult track and field events. And the one who wins the gold medal in the decathlon is recognized as one of the world's greatest athletes. In the intellectual world, we have the so-called Renaissance man, person who has mastery of music and art and science and philosophy. Lahavdil, in the world of Torah, we also recognize the uniqueness of an individual who has this sense of hashlama, of this perfection in a broad, in many broad areas. The story is told of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement, who had a special fondness for one of his disciples, Rabbi Simcha Zisel Ziv, who was known as the Alter, the Elder of Kelim. And he compared this disciple, the Alter of Kelim, with a Gemara in Brachos, in Lama Tesel Med Beis, 39b, where it speaks, a person has a meal, and he has two rolls in front of him. He plants eat both at the meal. One is a larger one that is no longer whole. A slice, part of it has been taken off. The other one is smaller, but is a sholem, is whole. There's no imperfections. And after one washes, and one is going to make the bracha of hamotzi, the benediction, one should choose the sholem, the complete one, to begin eating, rather than the larger but incomplete one. The Torah values completeness. And Rasul Salanter said about this disciple that he had, Rasul had many extraordinary disciples. But what makes Rav Simcha Zisel so unique is that he was a sholem, that he excelled in so many different areas. Perhaps in every area there was one that was better than he, but there was no one that excelled across the broad spectrum of areas. In the period that we're studying tonight, there's one person that stands out, that has this maila, the special quality of shlemos, of this broad perfection. And that's Rabbi Yoshua, the subject of tonight's lecture. If you look at the first page of the notes, in Ovos, we have the quote of Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Yeshua's teacher, who made comments about each and every one of his chief disciples. Last time we studied Rabbi Eliezer. The only words of praise that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had for this disciple was Ashrei Yoladeto. Happy or fortunate is the mother who bore him. And as you see in the commentary of Rabbeinu Yonah, I'm going to quote, the expression fortunate or praiseworthy, Ashrei, without qualification, indicates that it is all-encompassing. Rabbi Yeshua embraced all the positive qualities for which a person is considered fortunate or praiseworthy. His uniqueness was that he was so good at so much. If you continue on, the quote from Rashi on Avos, Rabbi Yeshua was an expert in all subjects of study. He was an advisor. In other words, he had great insights into human behavior and knew how to advise someone and was close to the government. One wonders, we're all worrying about our children, how they'll develop to be their best. And it seems that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in praising Rabbi Yeshua, not only praised him, but praised his mother as well. What did his mother do to deserve that praise? We don't find in any of the other disciples that the mother is mentioned. And I'll continue on with the Rashi. I have heard, that he grew up to be such a sage because of his mother. The whole time she was pregnant, she would go around to the study halls in the city and ask them, I beseech you, please pray that this fetus, the Uber, should grow up to be a sage. Evidently, according to Rashi, the mother deserves much credit. And in it, you see not only the role of the mother, but the power of prayer. But the Yerushalmi has a different version of Rabbi Yeshua's mother's role. And this is from Yerushalmi Yevamos. And he said, referring to his Rabbi Yeshua, and he remembered his mother, he says, I recall that his mother would bring his crib to the synagogue, to the shul, so that his ears would cling to the words of Torah. In the shuls there, after the davening, after the prayer service, the room would be used as a cheder, as a yeshiva for small children. And she would bring in the crib so that the words, through osmosis, the words would make, and it would make, have an effect. Like mothers in the audience, please listen. You know. Again, we see the role, evidently, how he turned out to be as a result of his mother. But we see the role of the environment. What was this little baby exposed to? He couldn't understand these words. He was an infant. He was in a crib. But somehow the sanctity, the vibrations, the aura that was created in that atmosphere had a profound effect upon him. In Ovos Rabbi Nosson, there's another version of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's comment about Rabbi Yeshua. And here he says, he quotes the verse in Koheles, Hachut ha-mashulosh lo b'meheri yinosek. The threefold cord is not quickly broken. And this, the commentaries explain, refers, again, because of his broad, because in so many broad areas he excelled, that each one buttressed the other. So it's because he was outstanding, because he was so good at so much. But despite his profound qualities, his understanding, his mastery of Tanakh, of the Hebrew Bible, of the Talmud, of the associated literature, the commentaries, his profound understanding of human nature, he had a disability, and he was not a very handsome person. And it really makes all the more so that his successes were despite the fact that his physical appearance was so unpleasant. And I'd like to share with you an interesting incident about his appearance. It's on page 2, paragraph D. The emperor's daughter said to Yeshua ben Hananya, "Such comely wisdom, this is Torah Mefuora, such comely wisdom in an ugly vessel, Bakli Mechur." And she was taunting him. She said he was so brilliant, and evidently both his looks repulsed her. And as he replied, "Learn from your father's palace. And what is the wine stored?" So she replied, "In earthen jars." He continued, "But all people store in earthen jars, and you do likewise." I mean, that's for commoners. "You should keep in jars of gold and silver." So she went and had the wine replaced in vessels of gold and silver. And because the interaction of the wine and the metal, it turned sour. "Thus," he said to her, says, the Gemara in Tainus has it, that actually the king was involved, and "What did you do?" This is the Gemara in Tainus and Dav Zion. So he says, "The Torah is just like this. The Torah is like wine. It could only be kept in the most simple of vessels, and that will preserve it." But she asked, "But aren't there handsome people who learn it too?" And we know there were very handsome people that were very learned. And he replied, "But were they ugly?" Or as the Marsha says, "If they wouldn't pay attention to their looks, it wouldn't play a role in their life, they would even be more learned." I find this just as a fascinating insight. He was versed in Torah. He was able to speak in the princely courts. He was also an expert of Kabbalah, of the mystic wisdom. As is quoted in the Gemara Chagiga, that he delivered a discourse in the presence of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was pleased with his profound understanding. He was also a master of languages. If you look at paragraph F on the second page, quotes is that in the Sanhedrin that was in Yavna, there were four that mastered all the languages the Jews spoke, and it was important to at least be some members of the Sanhedrin that were able to be conversant in foreign languages, because this was the central court for all of Jewry. And any difficulties that were not resolved in other places were brought ultimately to this court. And when Jewry was in exile, Hebrew was no longer their tongue. It was important that members of the Sanhedrin were conversant in other tongues. And as you see, Rabbi Eliezer, which was a subject of last time's lecture, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Akiva, and Shimon says, Hatemoni, were those who were versed. But Rabbi Yeshua, there were many other great scholars in the Sanhedrin. But Rabbi Yeshua was one of those select few who had the mastery of all these languages. And second to the Nasi, would be the prince of the Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yeshua had the highest position, according to the Gemara in Bava Kamma. He was the Av Beis Din. He was the head of the rabbinical court. If you remember in previous lectures, we spoke about the Zugos. Those are these pairs of scholars that are mentioned in Pirkei Avos. Hillel and Shammai, this one famous Zug, one famous pair. Hillel was the Nasi, was the president, the prince of the Sanhedrin. Shammai was the Av Beis Din, that was the title, and it was second to the prince. He was the head of the rabbinical court, when it functioned as a court in the Sanhedrin. Rabbi Yeshua had that title. So even though he did not come from the family of Hillel, he did not earn the position. He didn't have the position by virtue of birth, but he had the highest position that was attainable by virtue of merit. The Talmud gives us an inkling of his scientific knowledge as well. On page 3, as quoting the Gemara in Horius and Yudom and Aleph and 10a, the Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua once traveling on a ship. Rabbi Gamliel took bread with him. They figured the trip would only take so much and so much and so long, and he took enough provisions for the trip. Rabbi Yeshua had with him bread and flour. In other words, that he had flour. If need be, if the bread would run out, he'd be able to bake again. When Rabbi Gamliel's and the trip took a lot longer than they had originally planned. When Gamliel's bread was consumed, he depended on Rabbi Yeshua's flour. So Rabbi Gamliel didn't understand this. He asked him, "Did you know that it would take so long? He brought flour with you?" So he says, "You know, a certain star rises once in 70 years." Seems to be referring to Halley's Comet, and leads the sailors astray because they navigate at night. They navigate by virtue of stars. And I suspect it might rise and lead us astray. So just in case, I brought extra flour. He says, "You possess so much knowledge," the former said to him, "and you must travel on board a ship." Rabbi Yeshua went for business. He says, "A person with your knowledge and with your understanding should be fabulously wealthy." Unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way. One interesting facet, besides his tremendous knowledge, was his being a Levi. And he wasn't just a Levi that one calls up the one after the Kohen, but really he served in the temple. And there's an incident, really we bring two incidents about Rabbi Yeshua while he was in the temple. One is a Gemara in Erechin, in Yud Aleph Amud Beis in 11b. Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgoda, who was another Tana, who was another of the teachers of the Mishnah, was one who was closing, his task was to close the temple doors. Rabbi Yeshua, whose position as a Levite was to sing. Now, he may not have good looks, but you know, he could really, he was able, he had the ability to sing. And Rabbi Yeshua went to help Rabbi Yechim ben Gudgoda. So Rabbi Yechim ben Gudgoda replied, says, "You're from the singers. You're from the Meshurim, the choristers, not the doorkeepers. And a Levi is not allowed to change his position. You have a specific task, and you shouldn't change." In other words, and you're not allowed really to do my work. This was a meshoyer, one who sings is not allowed to be a shoyar, one who closes, who controls the gates. Everyone has a specific function. It reminds me of the story, getting a little far afield. It was a beautiful story I have to share with you. We spoke previously about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement. And we spoke about one of his disciples. I'd like to tell you about another one of his disciples. He was known as Rabbi Yitzchok Petterberger. This is Rabbi Yitzchok Blozer was his name. He was the chief rabbi at the time of St. Petersburg, Russia. It was very difficult to become a rabbi in St. Petersburg, not because of the qualifications. There were cities that had illustrious rabbis and had a very distinguished laity. But the government, because of the laws of a settlement in the Pale, did not normally allow Jews to go into St. Petersburg. They needed special documentation and governmental permission to live beyond the Pale. St. Petersburg was in Russia proper. I'm not sure, but those who became rabbis had to learn certain trades, you know, an ink maker, a bookbinder, something that they were able to be allowed to live beyond the Pale on the basis that their services were needed for the Russians, you know, as a whole. So those who lived in those communities were either highly educated, you know, at least much more so than, you know, secularly educated than the Jews who lived in the Pale, or they were involved in governmental activities that were, business dealings were beneficial to the government. So I'm not sure under what guise Rabbi Yitzchok was allowed to settle there, but he came with those qualifications, but was appointed, of course, to be chief rabbi. And in his congregation in St. Petersburg, there was a very wealthy Jew who supplied provisions for the Russian government, for the Russian army. So he was a major supplier, and as a result, he made a wonderful living. He had one drawback, though. He was very stingy. And people who would come, you know, for alms, or there would be specific communal needs in St. Petersburg or beyond, he would be the last one to offer help. There was one a certain occasion, and there was a desperate need. And Rabbi Yitzchok, the chief rabbi himself, came to approach this supplier, this Jew, to help on this cause. And he found him in shul. And he was very frum, was very, very devout. And he was saying Tehillim, he was saying Psalms. And he was busy saying Tehillim. And Rabbi Yitzchok looked at him, and he said, "I want to explain something to you. You're a supplier to the Russian army. You're familiar with the regulations of the army. What happens if somebody from the artillery went to join the infantry?" So the man replied, "Well, if he just got up and left without permission on his own, he'd be court-martialed. I mean, he was placed originally in the artillery. He just can't leave his unit." He says, "You know what? God also has units in his army. He has the philanthropists, and he has the teachers, and he has those who say psalms, the Tehillim Zogers. He has a whole army as well. You know, if God had wanted to put you in the division of the Tehillim Zogers, of those who say psalms, he didn't have to bestow you with all this wealth. Evidently, he gave you all this wealth because he put you in the division of the philanthropists." She says, "You know," she says, "you deserted your unit. What are you doing saying Tehillim now? What are you saying Psalms? You should be going out and helping the community." I think it was a beautiful mashal. In a certain sense, each of us is given certain talents given certain opportunities. And really that's our role in that army, to utilize our talents and all that's given to us in the maximum way. We see that there is a sense of order. Don't desert your unit. The incident of Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananias and Rechem ben Gudgoda has this idea of order and system applies in a most dramatic way to the Levites. In fact, if a Levi would desert his post, so to speak, he's the singer and becomes one who closes the doors, he would be high of Misa. He would be culpable. He would be of the death penalty. Minas Shemayim is divine death penalty. But just it's so important that one preserves one's role. There's another incident that we have about Rabbi Yeshua and the Beis HaMikdash in the temple. And that is on page 3b. It was taught, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananias stated, This is an inside story of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. There was a tremendous simcha, a celebration that happened every Sukkos in the Beis HaMikdash, and surrounded the water libation. There was a special sacrifice that was offered uniquely on Sukkos, where the water was taken as a sacrifice and poured on the altar. And concurrent with that was a whole rejoicing. Even to this day, as a remembrance of that rejoicing, on Sukkos, very often in the nights of Chol HaMoed, we have what is known as a Simchas Beis HaShoeva, this Simcha reminding us of this Shoeva's drawing the water and this water drawing ceremony. It was taught, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananias stated, when we used to rejoice at the place of the water drawing, our eyes saw no sleep. How was this? The first hour in the morning was a daily morning sacrifice. From there to prayers, they davened. Even the time of the temple, there was still davening. From there to the additional sacrifice, and then to the prayers, musaf, to the prayers, additional sacrifice, then to the house of study, then they sat and learned. Chol HaMoed, you're learning. Then eating and drinking, then the afternoon prayer, then the daily evening sacrifice, because he was a Levi, he was involved in all this. And after that, the rejoicing at the place of the water drawing of Simchas Beis HaShoeva. So the Gemara asked the question, he literally went without sleep. You just can't go 3 days. The body just can't function. So he says, while they stood at the thing, they kept on dozing off on everybody else's shoulders. And then they got, jogged back into, and they woke up. But he is the one who really gives us a sense of how it was, and his day was really full. I'm just going to mention in passing on page 4, there's another citation of his function as a Levi. He received Meiser. He received, this is the Meiser Rishon, the Meiser of the tithe that was given, the first tithe, and when the produce, when one produce has wheat, for instance, after all the wheat has been threshed and winnowed and has been placed in piles and stored, at that time tithes are taken. There's a small amount, which is normally 1/50, which is given to the Kohen, to the priest. And after that, a tenth is taken out, and that is given to the Levi. And we just have the Levite, and we have just a quote. We find just an incident, Rabban Gamliel, who will be the subject of the next lecture, giving a tenth, Maaser Rishon, to Rabbi Yeshua. But what makes Rabbi Yeshua so unique as a teacher to us? Beyond all his vast knowledge, was his tremendous wisdom, was his insight into human behavior. I'd like to share with you on page 4. Here, this is on section 3. There was it's a beautiful story. There was an incident with Rabbi Yeshua that a man came early in the morning to him. Now, someone came, a wayfarer. He gave him food and drink. I guess it's not sure at this point, but maybe it was later at night. He probably, you know, went from house to house. And later at night, he gave him his room and brought him up to the roof for the second story to sleep. When he was firmly in there, he gave him the bed and gave him the furnishings. It was a second story. And they had movable ladders. You know, he went up and then went down the ladder, you know, closed them up and wished them good night. Then Rabbi Yeshua took away the ladder. The guests didn't know about this. Evidently, Rabbi Yeshua woke up early in the morning. We'd be sure early in the morning he'd put back the ladder before anyone would get up. But he took away the ladder. Well, the guest woke up in the middle of the night after he needed his beauty rest, I guess, took the vessels that belonged to Rabbi Yeshua, like took everything in a big sack, wrapped them in his talus, and he was ready to make a go for it. You know? And we attempted to go down from the roof. You know, he was ready to, you know, got down that step. The step wasn't there. He had removed the ladder. He fell and broke his neck. In the morning, Rabbi Yeshua got up, you know, and found him sprawled out. And I said, like, you know, what are you doing here? And he said, Reka, you know, rose. This is what people like you do. You know, this is how you repay my hospitality. Here I see you, brother. You took all the silver. You took all the stuff that I had upstairs. And Rabbi Yeshua really didn't have all that much. He was not very wealthy. But whatever he had was precious to him. And he replied, says, you know, Rabbi, I didn't realize you removed the ladder. He says, didn't you know I was on my guard? He says like this. Rabbi Yeshua said from this instant, he says, you know, every person should be held in your eyes like a thief. But you should honor him as if you would be Rabban Gamliel. In other words, you never know what the person is. So you always have to be wary. On one hand, he could be a very prestigious person. And you should, and any reservations you have, you should keep to yourself. You should honor him. You should give him all the kavod, all the honor. Bistung Rabban Gamliel, who had the highest office, he was the Nasi. But on the other hand, says, you have to be on your guard. So therefore, that's why he took away the ladder. And this is the source of the saying. This is Chabdeu v'chashdeu. You should honor him, but suspect him all the while. Rabbi Yeshua also not only shared his own wisdom with us, but shared with us the wisdom of others. There's a Gemara in Erevin, in Gimel Amud Beis in 53b. He said, Rabbi Yeshua Chanan, he said, no one has had the better of me. You know, he was very sharp, Rabbi Yeshua, except a woman, a little boy, and a little girl. What was the incident with the woman? I was once staying in an inn, for a few days, where the hostess served me beans. A peas. On the first day, I ate all of them, leaving nothing. The norm, I mean, he wasn't aware of it, but the normal, what would be called the derech eretz, would be the normal etiquette, would be to leave over a portion of the plate uneaten, as one would, you know, sharavek, one would take a part of the plate, you know, leave it uneaten. Eat the rest and leave that uneaten portion for the waitress or the waiter. That was the etiquette then. This even brought in Shulchan Aruch. That was the common etiquette. Now we leave a tip. Then they left over a little bit of the food. Yeah. On the second day too, he said, I left nothing. But on the third day, and she was very angry, this waitress. You know, this is like going to a high class restaurant without leaving a tip. You know. She over seasoned those beans with salt. So as soon as Rabbi Yeshua tasted it, he said, well, I couldn't taste it. So I didn't eat any more. So she went over to him and says, Rebbe, you know, why aren't you eating? I'm not hungry. He says, you know, I've already eaten, you know, early. I just don't have an appetite. You know, you should learn, you know, you shouldn't have eaten so much last meal. You know, you'd have appetite for this one. But then she leveled with him, you know, is it possible, you know, that, you know, maybe you didn't, maybe you didn't leave, you know, enough in the first time, you know, that you're just making up for it right now. Maybe this is your tip, right? And he learned his lesson, you know, to leave over something. You know, she said, you know, she quoted for him, you know, don't the sages say that something must be left, you know, that's left over in the plate, you know, as a compensation. You know, says, you know, I learned my lesson. She taught me well. But evidently he was telling over this story in admiration for her wisdom. In other words, had she just said it, it probably wouldn't have made such a profound effect on him as she oversalted it. I'm sure there was never a time afterwards where he did not leave over for the waitress. What was the incident with the little girl? I was once on a journey, and he saw and I observed a path across a field. You know, so it was a path, you know, and I went through the path. And a little girl called out to me, says, Rebbe, you know, says, you know, what are you doing in the field? It's part of the field. She says, no, this is a trodden path. She says, robbers like you, says, trod it down. And it was by the fact that it's trodden doesn't mean that it's public property. It just means that people have taken advantage of our property, you know, have just made a shortcut through our property. So he says, I learned my lesson from this little girl as well. What was the incident with the little boy? He says, I was once on a journey. I noticed a little boy sitting at a crossroads. And he asked, which road, you know, will get me to town? So he says, this one here is short. So derech tzora, it's short. Shiha Rucha, but it's long. And that one's long, but it's short. He didn't really understand. Rabbi Yeshua really didn't understand the boy's reply. He figured this is the short one, you know, so I'll take the short one. I put it along the short but long road, and I went. Everything was going well until I saw it was blocked by gardens, orchards, and as the road came to a dead end, and I couldn't go any further. Then I had to turn around and go all the way back to the crossroads. So he saw the kid was still sitting on the crossroads. He says, my son, says, didn't you tell me that this was the short road? He says, yeah, but I also told you it's long. He says, in other words, if you could make your way through those hedges and this, you would get to town. But, you know, I kissed him upon his head and said to him, happy are you, O Israel, all of you are wise, both young and old. The Medrash Eicha on page 6 expands on those incidents, quotes those incidents, and brings a few more. He left and found a young child with a covered vessel in his hand. You know, he had a, you know, he had a, you know, some sort of a, of a pitcher or whatever, and it was covered. And he asked the kid, you know, what are you holding in that covered vessel? You know, what's in there? You know, and he says, if my mother wanted you to know, she wouldn't have covered it. At another time, he found a young girl standing. She was by a well and filling, you know, water, you know, filling her vessel, the pitcher or the bucket with the well. And he said, could you please give me water to drink? You know, he was walking on the road. He was thirsty. And he says, for you and your donkey. And it's not only you, I'll give your donkey as well, which is reminiscent of, you know, the story of Rivka. You know. So when he had drunk and turned to leave, he said, "My daughter, you've done just like Rivka." She replied, "Yeah, I was like Rivka, but you weren't like Eliezer. You know, Eliezer gave all the gold and the trinkets, you know, all the everything." And he was impressed, you know, the chachma, the wisdom of Jewish kids. But besides the chochmalach, in other words, as a teacher, he gave us a great insight into our own nature. This is an Ovos on page 6. This is in Pirkei Ovos, in the second parak, we have a quote from Rabbi Yeshua. And he says, "Ayin hara, an evil eye," in other words, means jealousy or greed, in other words, you're intolerant of, you don't feel comfortable with the success of others. This is yetzer hara, the evil inclination. In other words, it's referring like this, as Freud would say, the id. In other words, it's always this need for pleasure. And hatred of other people. Now, this is one thing of the jealousy. The ayin hara is the jealousy that burns a person up. The sina is really, it's related to the person. Just, I can't stand him. It says, "Mitzinas adam min olam," remove a person from the world. And there's a person, both it means the spiritual world, because a person who's governed by all these impulses will never grow spiritually. But also means physically. I mean, person literally eats up a person. A person has all the aggravation and all the pain that the other person has and I don't have. Or all these unfulfilled desires that keep on nudging. If only I had that, then I'd be happy. You know? Then it turns to something else. If only that, then I'll be happy. And this whole feeling of you looking at this, you know, these, you know, the hatred of people, you know, he's done this to me, or he's going to do, or this literally eats up a personal life. And basically Rabbi Yeshua says a person has to change in order to just simply survive as on this planet as a human being. One has to change his whole attitude for one's longevity. One should be tolerant of others and be happy. He has, I have. I have mine with all that I need, and he, Baruch Hashem, has what he has. The idea of the Yetzer Hara, that a person has this whole need for physical fulfillment, has to be tempered and directed. The person has to live with a higher goal and use all his drives that will be used in moderation towards this higher goal. And also a person should love humanity. I mean, everybody has positive things. And no one could hurt you, you know, if Hashem is protecting you. You know, wish everybody well. Not only is it advice to get to the next world, but it's advice to survive in this world. Rabbi Yeshua also taught us, I want to share with you a quote from the Medrash Rabbah, beautiful quote. You could look at it yourself, but in essence, he says, "Yoisim mashal balabais oisim ha'oni, greater than that which the philanthropist does with the poor person, this gives him X amount of dollars or food or whatever. Ha'oni oisim ha'balabais. The poor man does far more to the rich man, but because since the poor man was the recipient of that philanthropy and enabled that wealthy person, the philanthropist, to do the mitzvah will grant rewards far beyond the few dollars or the little food that was given to the poor man. There's a person that, you know, very often you've by unusual people, you see that When a Rosh Yeshiva, when someone is collecting for a worthy cause, a yeshiva or some other cause, and the Rosh Yeshiva thanks the philanthropist, the giver, for being so nice and giving. Very often you hear us of the philanthropist, on the contrary, thanking the Rosh Yeshiva, thank you for giving me the opportunity of supporting, you know, this cause, this institution. It's based on Rabbi Yeshua. Because the reward that Hashem gives to those who share is far greater than what one loses by sharing. And this is Rabbi Yeshua's insight. It's a beautiful, beautiful idea. But Rabbi Yeshua is not just a teacher of Jews. There's a whole literature. Which dealt with Rabbi Yeshua's involvement with the Roman government. The first incident is his indirect involvement, and this is in the days shortly after the destruction of the temple, that he went to save Jews from imprisonment. And he found this beautiful child, and he stood and he quoted the pasuk. He quoted the verse, and he says, "Minosin l'meshisa Yaakov v'Yisrael l'boizazim." Says, "Who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers?" Like, what was the cause of that all has befallen the Jewish people? And the child answered. You have to realize this is a child who was probably dragged thousands and thousands of miles from, indirectly probably, in a circuitous route from Palestine to Rome. He's in prison. This little child says, "It's not the Lord." And he quoted the end of the pasuk. It wasn't God himself who's responsible. It's we who are responsible. Had we lived a better life, all of this would never have happened. And when Rabbi Yeshua saw how this child replied, not only did he quote this verse verbatim, but he just saw that the resolve that this child had. He says, "I feel sure that this won't be a teacher," says, "and a halacha guide in Israel." He says, "And I swear I'll not budge from here before I ransom him, whatever the price may be." And it's reported that he ransomed him at an exorbitant price. And he went on to be one of the greatest teachers of Yisroel, and this is Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. We studied in a previous lecture Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha Kohen Gadol, the high priest. According to Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, this Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha was a grandson of the Rabbi Yishmael, the high priest that was martyred. Just before we leave this passage, I mean, not only do we find Rabbi Yeshua actually saved this child, but he was able to get hold of the monies, which was a no mean feat after the destruction of the temple, after so much was destroyed, to save these. Tosfos asks a question. The Tosfos commentary asks the question on this Gemara. Is that we have a rule that that one should not go over certain limits when redeeming captives, for the fear that it will have a deleterious effect on the community as a whole. Once they jack up the prices for captives, as everyone will be open to be shanghaied, to be kidnapped and then ransomed. So we try to keep the prices low, and we do not go over a certain, will be a standard price for a captive. So how is Rabbi Yeshua allowed to redeem Rabbi Yishmael? Was that this evidently a very, very high price? And Tosfos has several answers. This replies to this. One of the answers, and is important to share with you, is that ultimately, the reason why this law was made, that there's certain limits in ransom, was for the benefit of the community. But he said, but the ultimate benefit of the community is that there should be Talmid HaChachamim, there should be scholars. And that's a goal which overrides all other considerations. Which was an interesting reply. There's a whole literature, though, of Rabbi Yeshua's conversations with the emperor. It seems to be the Emperor Hadrian. And I'd like to just quote some of these. It's just fascinating. Again, we see, we have an inkling of the wisdom of how Rabbi Yeshua was able to deal with the emperor. If when you deal with the Roman emperor, it's not like the President of the United States. You know, if he doesn't like you, it's like the Queen of Hearts. You know, the emperor said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, "I wish to see your God." So Rabbi Yeshua says, "You can't see him." He says, "I want to see your God. Like, don't give me any excuses." So good. So he went and placed the emperor facing the sun. This was in the summer solstice. And said to him, "Look up, and I want you to stare at the sun." He says, "I can't look at the sun." So he says, "You know, the sun is just one of the minor servants that God has. If you can't look at the sun, how could you think to look at God himself?" I guess that was enough for the emperor. But there's another, and that's a Gemara in Chulin, in Nuntesom and Beis in 59b. There's another Gemara in Shabbos, in Kufyu Tesom et Aleph in 119a. That the emperor said to Yeshua ben Hananya, "Why do the dishes on Shabbos smell so good? Like, there's something special about that which we have on Shabbos." He says, you know, we have a certain seasoning. It's called Shabbos. That's the thing that gives it. That's it. Could you give me some of it? If you keep Shabbos, you'll enjoy it. If you don't keep Shabbos, it's meaningless. There's an incident which is quoted in the Medrash Rus, which gives us not only an insight into Rabbi Yeshua's wisdom, but into Jewry as a whole. Hadrian, here the emperor is mentioned by name with the compliment, "May his bones be crushed." He was responsible, as we'll see at a later time, for the destruction of Beitar, for enormous suffering of Jewry. But Hadrian asked Rabbi Yeshua, "You know, I'm better than Moshe, than, you know, Moses." "From Moshe Rabbeinu." "He says, why?" "You know, because I'm alive and he's dead." You know, it says in Kohelis, you know, a live dog. It says, that a live dog's better than a dead lion. So Rabbi Yeshua replied, says, "Can you decree that no one will be allowed to light a fire for 3 days?" "Do you think you're so great?" He says, "Yeah, I'm the emperor." "Fine. No one shall light at night." This is right after he made the decree, right? They went up to the roof of the palace and they looked and they saw smoke rising from a certain house. So they followed the trail of the smoke, and they went and says, "What's this all about?" "And this is a decree here." So they replied, you know, the mayor of the village became sick and a doctor came in and told him that he has to drink hot water. You know, so he needs hot water to get better. So so Yeshua says, "You know, Moshe, our teacher, from the time he decreed, 'Lo savar esh b'chol Moshe v'sechem v'yem haShabbos,' you're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. There hasn't been a Jew who has lit a fire on Shabbos." He says, "How can you say you're better than he?" It gives you an insight of what Jewry was. You know, it's hard to see today how many Jews, what percent of Jews But in Rabbi Yeshua's time, it was well over 1,000 years after the Torah was given, 1,500 years. According to him, there hasn't been a Jew. I mean, I'm sure there have been a handful of Mishumodim, you know, and there's people who totally have. But if there's even the Tzedukim, you know, the Sadducees, kept Shabbos. They would never do this on Shabbos. So it may be hyperbola. We find the Misyavnim, you know, those who, you know, in the time of the Chashmonaim, but it's very, very rare. By and large, wherever there was a Jew, he always kept Shabbos. There's another conversation that's recorded, which is, part of it is a classic, which is often quoted. Hadrian asked Rabbi Yeshua, this is in Esther, this is in the Medrash Esther Rabbah, and there's a question in the commentaries how to even read this, how to interpret this sentence. And according to one of the commentaries, and that's what I used in translation, it says, you know, the Jews must be a very powerful nation. It says they're a great, because it stands among 70 wolves, and it's still whole. This is the quote very often you find about the lamb and 70 wolves. This is the source. He says, no, it's not because the Jews are so strong. As great as the shepherd, great as Hashem, who saves them and breaks the power of the wolves that stand before them. Our survival is a miracle. This is not due to any great strength the Jews have. We live by the grace of God. Another fascinating incident. Was that there was evidently a certain unbeliever, it's not clear, it could very well be an early Christian, was at the court of Caesar, which doesn't give the name, but in all probability it's Hadrian, and showed him a certain movement of the hand. In other words, they had, you know, we were familiar with mimes today, were able to do a whole, have a whole act just, you know, just through. They had these movements as well. And he wanted to show this apikeiros, this disbeliever, this Christian, wanted to show us is that that God had forsaken the Jewish people. And he made a certain movement of his hand which shows a people whose Lord has turned his face from them. You know, it's, so Rabbi Yeshua made a movement with his hand, and he says his hand is stretched over us. He's still protecting us. His Yod Netuyo Leino, his hand is stretched over us. So Caesar asked Rabbi Yeshua, do you know what his original comment was? What was his original movement? What did he show you? So he says, you know, his people, you know, he wanted to say that, you know, God has shunned his people, turned away his people from him. And I showed him, by my action, that his hand is stretched still over us. And Caesar said to the heretic, what did you show him? And it conformed. It was the people that God's turned us away from. What did he show you? He says, I don't know. You know, it says, a person who doesn't understand what's being shown, you know, if you're an amateur in this, you shouldn't have done it, at least not in my presence. You know, if you don't understand hand gestures, you know, just don't. He says, you shouldn't have done this. And he led him forth and slew him. You know, evidently, it was an amateur night over there in Caesar's palace. There's another personal incident that's recorded. which is not so pleasant in the life of Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua had a nephew. This is Hanina or Hananya ben Achi Rabbi Yeshua. Hananya was the son of the brother of Rabbi Yeshua. He went to the story as it's given is very cryptic. So he went to Kfar Nachum. This is Capernaum. This was one of the residences of the founder of Christianity. In his time, the people, by and large, did not accept him. But it later became a center of the early Christian church. The story, as it's told, is, as we said, is very cryptic. I took the interpretation of Rav Aaron Hyman, who's the author of Toldos Tanoim V'Amoraim. And we'll read this together. He went to Capernaum, which is the center of early Christianity. They did something to him, which according to Rav Aaron Hyman means they convinced him. And thereby, this is the quote, they rode him on a donkey on the Sabbath. That's the language of the Medrash, which Rav Hyman interprets to mean that the donkey is an allusion. This is the pasuk in Zechariah, and this is the verse in Zechariah in chapter 9, that the Messiah will come Oni Roichav Alachamor, a poor man riding on a donkey. And this was, of course, this is a story in the New Testament, that the founder of Christianity comes into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. And the Sabbath is the reference to Yom Shekulei Shabbos. In other words, the Sabbath refers to the great day. So they rode him on a donkey on the Sabbath is just an allusion. Evidently, they didn't want to say it in so many words, that they convinced him that they convinced Hananya that Yeshu, was the founder of Christianity, was indeed the Messiah. He went back to Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Yeshua put on him oil. That's the language, Yovel of Moshach v'Itzi. Put on oil and he was healed. Which according to Rav Hyman is an allusion, the word oil is Moshiach. It's Moshach, as anointed. In other words, he convinced him that Yeshu was not the Moshiach. But he said, since the donkey of the evil person, and it's interesting how he referred to Yeshu as the evil person, was aroused in you, you cannot dwell any longer in the land of Israel. Go down from here to Babylon, and there you should remain and die in peace. And it seems that from that time on, Hananya left Eretz Yisrael, left Israel, and went to live in Babylon, where he became one of the most prominent scholars in Babylon. But he felt that evidently Christianity had not taken such a hold in Babylon at the time, and it was important for him to keep away from those who have had previously such an influence on him. And it gives you a sense of the power of the early church. If they could convince someone who was, I don't know, at that time, but later on became one of the Tanoim. The next incident, this is the last story that we're going to have, which is one which tells us much of the history of the time. In the time of Rabbi Yeshua, just towards the end of his life, it seems, Hadrian, it seems from historians and from church history, when he came to the throne, this is approximately year 119, when he came to the throne, he wanted to show goodwill towards the Jews and gave them permission to build the temple. And in fact, a whole Sipopas Lulianus, who were famed Jewish leaders, set up a whole system of offices, I think from Akko to Antioch. In other words, that people would start pouring in from the diaspora to start rebuilding the temple. And they provided gold, silver, and other needs to all those who were coming in from the diaspora. You could see the scene, like it was a whole, you know, this is the idea of Aliyah. In other words, they're all coming back with tremendous enthusiasm. The Samaritans, this is the age-old enemies, nemesis of the Jews, went to the emperor and said, and this is the Medrash here quotes, really these are really paraphrases, really quotes the complaints that the Samaritans originally made against the Jews. You know, this made into the Persians to temporarily halt the building of the temple in the Persian era. He says, if it will be rebuilt, so they won't pay their, it's a rebellious city. They have a whole history of not complying to the will of the government. They won't pay any of the taxes. And all you'll have, if they'll become a power again, you'll just have tsoros from them. You'll just have aggravation. So he said, what can I do? You know, I've decreed this already. So they suggest that, you know, you can't stop it, but you can alter it slightly. And what you should do is, I'll let you make the temple, but there has to be a slight change. Either change the place where the temple will be built and keep the original dimensions, or build it on the place and change the dimensions. Now the dimensions are really the temple are mandated by law. You can't just willfully change the dimensions. For him to give the decree, either change the location or the dimensions, meant that they were not, they just had no way of rebuilding the temple. And as a result of the influence of the Samaritans, the project was halted. It seems that the ill will that was brought and the frustration that was brought on by this about face of Hadrian, really eventually festered, at least as historians claim, and was one of the causes of the whole Bar Kokhba revolt. But they were unaware of Hadrian's reversal, and there was a communal meeting about the temple in a place called Beis Rimon. It was a valley, evidently it was a large area which could house many, many people. So as they were there, the official correspondence came to them telling them the change in plans. There was a group there already that says, we've had enough. We have to stand up for our rights. We have to revolt. And the leadership knew that they themselves didn't have the power of persuasion to deal with this rebel group. They said we should bring in some wise person to be able to quiet down the crowd. So he says, you know, another said, let's bring Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanani, Rabbi Yeshua. He's the Rosh Yeshiva. He's intelligent. He'll know how to deal with them. So Rabbi Yeshua, they brought him in. He came up, and this was the discourse, the drasha that he gave. He says, you know, a lion, you know, this is like one of Aesop's fables. He says, a lion finished eating his prey. He got a bone stuck in his throat. He couldn't remove it himself. You know, the paws and stuff. He promised the other animal, you know what? The one who removes the bone from my throat will be rewarded. So the stork came in, stuck its long beak, put its head in the lion's mouth, stuck in its beak, and removed the bone. After he did it, the stork asked the lion for the reward. You know what? You know what your reward is? From now on, you can tell everybody, you know, I put my head in the lion's mouth and I'm still alive. That's your reward. So Yeshua says, you know, it's enough for us to have come the mouth of the lion. We've dealt with the Romans. We've gone out in peace. All they said is you can't do it. They didn't come with an army against us. They didn't kill anybody. We should be happy. And it's with those words that at that point, at least, the potential rebellion was quelled. On the last page here, on page 11, we have the eulogy of Rabbi Yeshua. When he died, they, despite the fact his greatness in Torah, there were others who were still alive. Rabbi Akiva was alive. There were others that perhaps, in a certain sense, would replace him. But his etzah, his advice, his thought, that had come to an end. There was no one like him. And there was a concern in the Gemara Chagiga about how he was so able, he was so talented, he was so, to fend off the claims of the apostates, those of these Christians. But just like how he had convinced his nephew. He says, who is going to stand on our behalf now? Who's going to stand up and able to counter all their arguments? This was this before he died. This was like some of his last words, and they asked him, and he says, "Don't worry." And he quoted a verse in Yirmiyahu and Jeremiah. He's saying that there's always a balance in the world. When we have great minds, they have great minds to counter ours. But for whatever reason, we're bereft of such talent. Hashem in His goodness makes that the other side is also bereft of that talent. And the challenge is not anything that we're not capable of repulsing, of dealing with. He says, "Don't worry." He says, "In my generation, they had these problems. You won't have those problems in your generation." And with those words, he assured them. He was truly an unusual person, I'm just sure. Yes, Hashem. Next lecture in 2 weeks, we'll be dealing with the life of Rabbi Yeshua's contemporary. Or as we said, Rabbi Yeshua was the Av Beis Din, was the head of the rabbinical court. His superior, though, was Rabban Gamliel, the prince, the president, the Sanhedrin, the subject of the next lecture. Are there any questions?
Yes. Could you comment on the interaction between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva and their response to Hadrian's change of heart
Yeah, just so the question was asked about the different various roles we find Rabbi Yeshua to his attempt to quell the rebellion. As you're saying, Rabbi Akiva, we find a historical role seems to be supportive of the rebellion. First of all, it's important to note we're dealing with two different points of how this rebellion came to be. Rabbi Yeshua dealt with the initial stages. There wasn't a rebellion yet. There was just the first impulse to create a rebellion. There wasn't a Mashiach. There wasn't a Bar Kochva. There was just this gnawing frustration. And at that point, that was the incident that's quoted here. Some years later, and it's a question of what incited this revolt. Was it the frustration of the building of the temple? Was it, as Rav Isaac Halevi wants to point out, a systematic attempt on Hadrian's part to crush the Jewish spirit and to prevent the observance of the Torah and mitzvahs? But whatever it is, Rabbi Akiva's comment was after the fact, after there was a rebellion, and initially there were enormous successes, and all we find is a quote from Rabbi Akiva of Dorach Koich of Miyankov, that he felt that the prophecy of Bilam, that there would be this star from Jacob, refers to the Mashiach, is referring to Ben Koziva. That was Bar Kochva's name, and that's how we got the name Bar Kochva. That was after the fact. It's hard to know what Rabbi Akiva may have felt. In the initial stage of the rebellion was totally unproved. Evidently, Rabbi Akiva was so impressed with his successes, and evidently he must have been impressed just generally with the person, that after the success, he made the comment that he felt that Bar Kochva was the Mashiach. So it's hard to know, to compare the two. Perhaps if Yeshua would have been alive at that point, Rabbi Yeshua may have concurred. It's just hard to know. We're dealing with the post facto after the success. You know, it's not at the initial stages. So it's really just hard to, but the whole Bar Kochva revolt and Rabbi Akiva's role is really needs its own special treatment. Any other questions?
On the first or second page, you mentioned that one of his milas was that he was close to the government. I believe that we also learned that we as Jewish people are recommended to not be so close. If we look at his administration, we look at the kind of Jews that are they are not close to the government. They really, in the long run, have the possibility of making things quite difficult for us later.
Really, your basic question is really the quote from Pirkei Avos, right? It's about not being close to the government. I'm sure the Jews in the Clinton administration probably never read Pirkei Avos, so I don't think it's really, we don't have to look to them. It seems Rabbi Yeshua's being close to the government is not something that he volunteered, that he felt that, you know, if I'll, you know, come close to the government, it'll be helpful for myself, for my students, or for Jewry as a whole. The situation was, in that period, that he probably had no other choice, but as the representative of Jewry, when they always constantly made decrees, he, at that point, created a relationship with the emperor. I don't believe that he on his own made an appointment, went through a secretary, you know, we should get to know each other, you know, after our Palestine's part of your empire, you know, let me take you to a tour of the... I doubt that that's the scenario. We find in several places, this is quoted in the last lecture of Rabbi Eliezer, we'll find it quoted in further lectures as well, where the sages had to go to Rome. And Rabbi Yeshua invariably, when you had these missions, Rabbi Yeshua invariably was part of those missions. On those missions, he was able, in terms of his, which he was forced, because to fend off these decrees, he evidently met the emperor, and the emperor was very impressed with his brilliance. And by virtue of that fact, that they entered a certain relationship. I doubt, you know, so I don't think it's really a contradiction, the warning and of us not to get close to the government. It really wasn't his choice. Yeah. That's right. So, yes. According to Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, this is one of the common, Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid is a very famous personage. He was one of the Balei HaTosfos. He was in the school of the Tosfos. He's known for his, Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid is known for, he wrote the book Sefer Chassidim. You know, he's also the author of what's called the Tzavos Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. You know, he gave his last will and testament. There are commandments there, you know, that he had made as a question to his own personal family, as for Jewry as a whole. In there, there's the thing, two brothers should marry two sisters. That's a controversy he only meant to his family or to, this is a Tzavos Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. Many people are very, very wary of violating that Tzavo. Because it has to do with many mystical things. They say in the Kotzke Rebbe, you know, famous, one of the great Hasidic sages, Rebbes, said, you know, it's just too bad that the Ten Commandments are not part of the Tzavos for Yehuda Chosa, not part of his last will and testament, because people are so fearful to violate it that they would keep the Ten Commandments a little better. Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, in addition, has a version of Tosfos, you know, of the commentaries on the tractate Brachos. And he comments on this, and he said his theory, I mean, he doesn't know, but he wants to say that he actually, this one that was redeemed is a grandson of the one that was killed. The problem the question was asked, what is the exact function of Av Beis Din? What is that function, the head of the rabbinical versus that of the president, the Nasi? The problem with the study of history is that there are not enough facts to fit the whole picture. You know, it's like a little rug that you have on a floor, and you want to cover that section, so you pull it over there, and there's no rug on that part, and you pull it back, this part's covered, the other is uncovered. There's not enough facts. There's a lot of theories, though. The role of Beis Din would suggest that when in their capacity as a court, not just a yeshiva, that he would preside over the court. That's what would just seem from the... that would be different than the Nasi, that would really not be part of the court proceedings and perhaps not even have a vote in the court. It would just be an elder statesman. The Rav Isaac Halevi, the historian, and this is a theory that we quoted in a previous lecture, states that we find that there are 72 members of the Yeshiva of Yavne, the Zakenim, the elders of Yavne. There are probably many more, but just the elders were 72. We find that there are many, many more. It's strange. The number should be 71, not 72. The Sanhedrin is 71. So he says that 72nd member is the Nasi. It was an extra member. It was like a non-voting, someone who is above everything. So according to that, then in the proceedings of the Sanhedrin as a judicial body, the Av Beis Din would be the 71st. Whereas in judicial dealings, the Nasi would not really deal with those matters. He would be an advisor, but he would not actually vote. That would be according to... there seems to be other citations, at least in the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, that the Nasi did vote. It was a question of making legislation. Perhaps that's not a Beis Din, that's just a group that is going to initiate legislation. We do find that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did vote. But one possibility, al kaponim, is that he led the discussions, he chaired the Beis Din part. However, there's another source which is indicative that he, in terms of when it came to the study, in other words, they used to go through a masechta, you know, every so often. You know, they used to go, you know, through the tractate. The Nasi used to give shiurim, as he would give lectures. He would give lectures every Shabbos. Those lectures wouldn't necessarily be a halachic nature, it could be as well, but this is drush, it was being more homiletic. You know, but he was also, he was a spokesman, and just within as an orator. But when they had the discussions of the Talmud itself internally, the one who would lead the discussions, this is Matzias, a Mishnah, who would present the Mishnah and the problems and explain, was the Av Beis Din. I mean, it seems that there is a Rav Isaac Halevi, the sources which support this role of, in the discussions, he would, you know, they were learning a tractate, he would be the Rebbe, so to speak, the Abbez, and he would say over the Mishnah, he would say the explanations, and he would leave it open for discussion. So even though the leader was the Nasi, and he would be the one who would give the drushes, the Abbez then did not deliver discourses. That was the role of the Nasi, the president. However, internally, when they would discuss the Nasha, they would go through a Mishnah, the Av Beis Din, that would be his role, he would lead that discussion. Here the Nasi would just sit on the side, and that would be the function of the Av Beis Din to lead that discussion. So that was it seems, according to Rav Isaac Halevi, that was the role of the Av Beis Din, the Matzias HaMishnah, as when they go through anything, he would teach the Mishnah and go over, and then he would leave it open for discussion. And so he would chair that session, so to speak.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.